Can our government be competent? Jimmy Carter says yes. Jimmy Carter says yes. Can our government be honest? Jimmy Carter says yes. Jimmy Carter says yes. Can our
well, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Good to be back. Well, I don't know why I said good to be back. I haven't been anywhere. God damn it.
Well, we've been away for a week. I don't know, like five days. I mean, you know.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. What you were hearing there was my kind of mild discomfort at the way we introduced the show, which has always felt a little bit generic to me.
Isn't it funny that over the last, I'd say month especially, we've had such a hard time just like getting into the show, and we've recently passed 500 episodes. I think if you listen to episodes, I don't know, 300 through 450, we're probably like perfect at introducing the show. We have it down to a science, but at some point over the last few weeks, I don't know, something's gotten into the water. We can't quite get it together.
Well, we aren't recording this one in person, and we haven't been recording in person. I feel like I haven't seen Will for several months. I think it's only been about, what, 10 or 12 days, something like that. But you've been away, and I don't know, this has been a kind of uncomfortable return to like the pandemic era recording. Which, I don't know, is probably two seasons worth of Michael and Us at this point. I mean, that era kind of represented our biggest period of growth. I think, you know, both in terms of the audience and I think like conceptually the show grew the most during that period. But I didn't like it. I don't like not working together. I don't like not being in the same room to hash things out before the mics are on and that kind of thing. So I don't know, maybe that's where some of the discomfort at the introductions comes in. But look, we got to stop this because the sign of degeneracy in every show when it's, you know, been on for too long, like, you know, we're doing like Seinfeld, you know, season 9 shit here. We're doing like post season 9 of The Simpsons. The number one sign of degeneracy in any show or fictional universe is everything becoming too meta and like constantly winking at the audience and breaking the fourth wall. So I don't want us to enter our like, you know, killing Maude Flanders era. So let's get on with today's business.
Yeah, I think we're just getting started, honestly. I think the show's better than ever. And patreon.com/Michael and Us, you'll find further evidence of that. One groundbreaking episode after another.
There have been some good ones recently. You know, I think Will might have been a little skeptical when I suggested we do an episode on Dune, but I think that's probably one of our most popular Patreon episodes in quite a while.
I wasn't skeptical at all. I knew that was money in the bank. I have a mercenary side.
You weren't skeptical. You were cynical.
Yes, yes. I was cynical. That is the correct word. But I think the results are pretty good. You know, I may be cynical, but I do still want to deliver a quality product. So yeah, patreon.com/Michael and Us. We'll get a very good Dune 2 episode, and I'll be able to put my hypothetical children through hypothetical college. Speaking of degeneracy and beloved brands disintegrating before your very eyes. mere minutes before we pressed record, I saw a great tweet. Do they still call them tweets on the social media platform now known as X? And X/Twitter, by the way, is my...
The erstwhile bird site.
It is my muse. It is our muse. It is where we find out everything. The Turner Classic Movies Twitter account. Y'all know Turner Classic Movies. One of the last refuges on this godforsaken earth. It's a cable channel that I don't think has ever been profitable per se, but it wasn't meant to be profitable. It was Ted Turner created it basically as like a success. Desteem. You know, this is where the real movie people go. They get to have fun here, and it's a loss leader.
Can I ask an embarrassing point of information? Is Turner Classic Movies a channel, or has it become a streaming platform? Can you watch stuff on demand there?
I believe it is still merely a cable channel. It has had, over the past few decades, pretty rigorous and creative programming. It's an oasis in the desert. Anyway, a year or two ago brought news that your friend and mine, David Zaslav, was firing the whole programming team, you know, was doing major, major cost-cutting measures on it. And this led to an intervention by a superstar panel of filmmakers, including Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, and Paul Thomas Anderson. They all had an emergency call with him, basically, to say, please, please don't gut Turner Classic Movies. We love you. We respect you. You're a great man, but please don't gut Turner Classic Movies. And this led to a sort of compromise situation where
they were trying to push David Zaslav left.
Well, Zaslav got them all to agree to do curation on the channel. So now, like every month or so, you'll get to see like Steven Spielberg presents some movies that he likes. Or...
They did a bipartisan compromise.
I mean, they used to have programmers on the channel, and maybe they still do, but programmers on the channel who would really know what was happening in the world of film. And now Zaslav has recruited Steven Spielberg, a busy man, a man who has things going on, to take a little time out of his schedule to be like, One-Eyed Jax, I like that movie. Lawrence of Arabia, you can play that. But nevertheless, since then, you know, the channel has continued at a fairly consistent level of quality. But I saw just literally an hour ago, TCM, their official Twitter account, posted the next chapter in the Batman saga from Matt Reeves. Academy Award nominee Colin Farrell is the Penguin. Hashtag the Penguin. In a new Max original series coming this fall to Max. So classic. If you don't get the point, it's coming to Max. And
I did not know that Will was going to bring this up. And my note for what to talk about next was ask Will about the new Batman thing.
Oh, well, I'm very excited to talk. I'm not excited to talk about it. I don't care. This is classic, you know, cross promotion. This is classic corporate synergy. And this goes all the way up to the top. This is David Zaslav, a classic bean counter, a classic knows the cost of everything and the value of nothing kind of guy, sitting around saying, well, hey, we have this other movie channel. They should be promoting the movies on Max. The Max, the place to be. What's the point of having this other movie channel if they don't promote that? Without sort of thinking that, well, you know, the people who watch Turner Classic Movies, that is their refuge from Max. They watch that channel so right. They don't have to think about Max. And this is just how it always goes. It reminds me of when Film Comment put Black Panther on the cover. You know, it's just, if you got the wrong people in the board of directors of any of these companies, this is just the way it always goes, isn't it? It's just synergy and maximizing profits. And it's always under the guise of, hey, listen, we like this thing too. We like this thing that's a refuge from the shit. But here's the thing. You've got to put a bit of the shit in it to preserve the thing that you like. And actually, what if it now becomes 50% shit? Hey, you still got 50%.
Right, I was going to say, there's always like a ratio of shit that keeps creeping upward.
And then it'll be like, oh, well, here's 10% of it. We're going to give you a Friday night slot that is the not shit anymore. And you get to have that. And you should be happy because Friday night is our least successful slot. It is the biggest money losing slot because on Saturday, we're playing reruns of Survivor Palau, 20th Anniversary Edition. And that gets five times as high ratings as the Friday slot gets. So you should consider yourself lucky. And then the next step is, what, you don't like Survivor Palau? It's, well, then you're an elitist. And then you don't even get the Friday night anymore. You don't even get that. So that's just the life cycle of things.
But the reason I was excited to bring it up is because I wanted to ask you, like, what is this new series going to reveal to us about the Penguin? Is this Penguin Origins? Like, how is this going to expand the Batman universe? Like, I thought that's why you were bringing it up. You're the Batman guy of the show.
Well, look, I'm optimistic about this show. I like Colin Farrell. I think he's a good actor. I like his interpretation of the Penguin. I mean, we used to just have portly character actors who could play roles like this instead of taking, you know, hot, cool Irish ruffians and dressing them up as portly character actors. But nevertheless, I'm sure it'll be an all right show for people who like this kind of thing.
Colin Farrell, you're stealing Danny DeVito valor. Unacceptable.
I think what I would just say is I'm a little bit skeptical of the business model, though. This feels kind of like the Star Warsification of Batman, where it's like, you know, in between the movies, which are the real things, they're now going to have like a trillion
Sorry,
different
well,
shows.
You suspect that this is what's happening? The Star Warsification is happening throughout our entire culture. They're making the entire culture out of Star Wars. Bill Corbett doesn't realize how prescient that tweet he had a few years ago was, where he tweeted a picture of the banana he'd got got at the grocery store that had like a Force Awakens sticker on it. And he asked, you know, why does my banana have to be Star Wars? Everything is just Star Warsification now.
I don't know if you know this, but for a few years, there was a show called Pennyworth that was about the adventures of Alfred the Butler before he became Alfred the Butler. Now, I haven't seen a single second of it. It ran for 3 or 4 seasons. And I always was kind of bemused by that premise. It's like, well, the whole point is that he's Batman's butler. Like, I don't, if there's no Batman there, I don't know. I don't get it. Alfred is not inherently interesting to me outside of the context of being Batman's friend.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward to the inevitable Star Trek The Next Generation spinoff where we get to find out what Miles O'Brien was doing in the transporter room for, you know, the other 12 hours a day when nothing was happening.
Can I just, before we move on to the next topic, briefly touch on another piece of Warner Brothers intellectual property? You know me, I love movie trailers. I love to react to movie trailers. I love to prognosticate. I love to see it and kind of spin fan theories about what the movie's going to be based on the trailer.
Well, you're both a great consumer and a producer of trailer reaction videos. This has been one of your things that you've become known for.
That's right. I like to watch it and be like, whoa, and be like, oh, and be like, it's a Wookiee, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But this week there was the trailer for the new Beetlejuice 2, which, God help me, ever since it was announced, you know, I've been burned so many times. Anytime there's a legacy sequel for like a movie that I liked when I was a child, you know, every single time I get disappointed. And then this one, there's still the 1% of me that's like Charlie Brown with the football. That's kind of like, God, wouldn't it be nice if Tim Burton was back? You know,
I love how wounded you sound. Like, you know, I've looked at Beetlejuice from both sides now. But
and the teaser trailer came out and whatever. It's like 30 seconds of footage from the movie itself. Who knows? Maybe the movie will be wonderful, but not based on the 30 seconds that I saw in that trailer. Where it's like, if you've seen the first Beetlejuice, you'll know that there was a big comic set piece of that movie involving the song Deo, you know, the Harry Belafonte song. Well, in this one, like any legacy sequel trailer, it opens with some minor key piano music, and you hear a voice go, Deo.
Me say Deo. Daylight come and me want to go.
Twinkly, downbeat, minor key rendition of Deo. And I saw a lot of people making fun of this because it's like with any legacy sequel. If there's a Ghostbusters sequel that comes out, there's a downbeat. Da 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 da. And it just feels a little ridiculous. Oh, yeah, this gag involving the song Deo from 37 years ago now gets resurrected in the trailer in a really po-faced way with utter solemnity. And then you see the trailer and it's Winona Ryder dressed exactly like she was in the first movie. Michael Keaton dressed exactly like he was in the first movie. All the same colors as the first movie. Show me something different, you know, for God's sake. So another sad experience. It feels like a conscious campaign to take every single thing I ever liked when I was a child and like drain all the life out of it. The trailer ends with Michael Keaton showing up and in his voice saying, "The juice is loose." And I thought, yeah, the juice, that's what this doesn't have.
The juice is loose.
Well, we have an interesting little curiosity to discuss on this week's episode. It's a fun little documentary about the institution of the American song poem. But before we get to that, I want to share something related that I've been working on. By the time this comes out, I think it probably will have been published, but I'm going to have a piece in the Toronto Star in the next few days. It's a somewhat lengthy piece about Paul Simon. This is, you know, my defense mechanism for, you know, resisting the Star Warsification of society. Also resisting the kinds of stuff that I normally have to write about. You know, I do like writing about politics. I guess there's a reason why I've done that, but sometimes it's nice to just write things in kind of a more, I don't know, appreciative register. It's nice to write things where you don't really have to make arguments in the same way.
Well, so many of the political arguments you've made over the last 8 or 9 years have been integrated into policy and are now being borne out by our leaders. So really most of the battles have been won, necessitating a pivot towards culture journalism.
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm writing about culture. You have me dead to rights. But yeah, so, you know, I wrote about Pink Floyd. I wrote about Werner Herzog for The Star. And I wanted to write this piece about Paul Simon, the occasion for which is this new documentary by Alex Gibney, who you can hear me interview actually on our Patreon, I don't know, a year and a half ago, along with David Sirota, about the podcast series they made on the financial crisis. But so Alex Gibney, with this new documentary, it's called In Restless Dreams, The Music of Paul Simon. He's basically sort of done for Paul Simon what, you know, Scorsese did for Dylan with No Direction Home. Although the sweep of this one is a little bigger. No Direction Home really just covers Bob Dylan's origins up to, you know, when he had his motorcycle crash, I guess right before he made John Wesley Harding. This film, you know, really covers everything from Paul Simon's childhood up until his present album, Seven Zalms, or I should say his most recent album. The only omission is the albums made between The Rhythm of the Saints, which came out in 1990, and Seven Zalms, the current one. I kind of wish there'd been a third episode. It's a pretty long documentary, but it's split into two episodes. And my only real criticism of it, I think, is that I wish it had just been a little more magisterial. Now, part of the reason I'm talking about this pertains to what Will and I are going to talk about in a few minutes, the American Song Poem. The thing I'm most interested in when I do a piece like this is, where does the artist method come from? You know, what are its component elements? And I actually found that more difficult to unpack vis-a-vis Paul Simon than I did, for example, when I reviewed Werner Herzog's memoir a few months ago. Because Werner Herzog in that book is very, very clear on what his artistic point of view is. I don't even intellectually agree with some of the constraints or conditions that he puts on good art, but it's kind of irrelevant. You can't deny the results. And from a reviewer's perspective, it actually makes things much easier because he's just telling you, you know, basic things like, I don't like the theorization of art, so I don't do it. And Paul Simon, I think, is a comparatively a pretty enigmatic figure. Like, I began the piece with this anecdote about him composing the Sound of Silence. You know, the story was that he, and you know, this is in the film, obviously, when Paul Simon was in his early 20s, he used to go into the bathroom at his parents' house and he would turn off the lights and leave the faucet running. And there was kind of just a pleasant ambient sound created by that. And on one particular occasion, sitting there in the darkness, he started picking this very evocative sequence of four notes, you know, the first four notes of the Sound of Silence, and found himself singing the words, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." Now, there's an alchemy to what's going on there. You know, I'm not sure how long it took for the full song to emerge after that, but there's a kind of intuitive process at work there that's pretty hard to unpack. You can't really intellectualize it. And Simon, just at every turn, seems like a person who has communicated primarily through his music. He's very, very private. And that made him a very interesting and challenging subject. Now, we're not here to talk about Paul Simon, but the other thing I want to bring up that's germane to what we're about to discuss is it really hit me while working on this piece and kind of reviewing the history of Paul Simon and also, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, just kind of how much failure there was before there was any success. I think not that many people probably know that Simon and Garfunkel, when they were called Tom and Jerry, had this hit in 1957. So they're like 15, 16 years old. And Paul Simon writes this very, you know, Everly Brothers derivative sort of bubblegum song called Hey Schoolgirl. And they actually have a minor hit. They go on American Bandstand. I think they shared a bill on that episode with Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, they sold something like 100,000 copies. And then after that, nothing happened. They did a bunch of subsequent singles and, you know, nothing clicked. So they went their separate ways and they just like both went off to school. Garfunkel went to study architecture and Simon went to study English. But Simon then spent the next 5 years just pumping out songs. So he wrote, you know, something like 40 songs in this period between 1957 and 1963 when he composed The Sound of Silence. And with one exception, absolutely none of these charted. You can listen to them. A lot of them are on YouTube, and they are extremely competent songs that are all within the sort of mainstream pop idioms of the time. They're these sort of four chord, you know, major, minor, doo-wop sort of things. There was one track that he did that did chart at number 97. It was called The Lone Teen Ranger. And it's basically the real life version of that novelty song from Inside Llewyn Davis. You know the one I'm talking about?
Please, Mr. Kennedy. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll show her away.
There goes the Lone Teen Ranger. Oh, he rides around on a big white horse. He's as cool as he can be. And my baby fell in love with him when she saw him on TV.
But anyway, Simon then really finds his voice, and he's still pretty young at this point. You know, he's in his early 20s when he writes The Sound of Silence. He and Garfunkel get an audition with Tom Wilson, who was, among other things, Bob Dylan's producer at Columbia. They perform The Sound of Silence. Wilson says, okay, that's great. We'll sign you. And they record their first album, Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m. Nothing happens. Nobody notices it. From the estimates I could find, it may have sold as few as 1,000 copies. And so they went their separate ways again. And it was quite by chance that Simon and Garfunkel happened at all. The version of Sound of Silence that most people will probably be familiar with is a version that Tom Wilson made unbeknownst to Simon or Garfunkel. He just decided to have Bob Dylan's studio band come in and overdub some drums and guitars, released it as a single, and then it shot to number one. And as Simon says in the documentary, I got back from England and like 2 weeks later, the song went to number one and I thought my life is irrevocably changed. So I don't know, as with any success, I think there's a whole lot of luck and chance and just kind of randomness to what gets through and what doesn't. And there is a very peculiar alchemy to songwriting that separates first absolutely unlistenable drivel from radio-friendly stuff that is competent but derivative. And then there's a further layer of separation between that and a song that's actually good, like The Sound of Silence.
My ad, this is in Writer's Digest magazine. I've advertised in here from the beginning for the last 16 years. Poem songs needed now, exclamation. Worldwide radio airplay, Hollywood TV show, CD release, free evaluation, possible royalties. And my address and my little logo on here, the magic keys.
When I first saw the ad, it talked about money making and it said songs. Get your poetry made into songs. Oh, this is interesting.
Well, our movie on this episode is Off the Charts, The Song Poem Story from the year 2003, directed by Jamie Meltzer. And I'm so glad you suggested this. This movie really hit me where I live. And there are many terrains of discussion here about what constitutes art, the relationship between art and commerce, what constitutes legitimacy in the arts, if you know what I mean, and what exploitation is and is not, and the gray areas where it may be. It's a documentary about a form that flourished in the mid-20th century and I think still continues in some small form today, although...
Some small form? Are you kidding me? It's just become SoundCloud. It's become Spotify. Well,
yes. I mean, I guess that's kind of what I'm getting to. The song poem, where in the 60s and 70s especially, particularly in big music hubs like Atlanta, Hollywood, New York, Chicago, but in other places as well, there would be services where you, the music fan, you, the amateur artist, could send in a poem that you wrote, and actual musical professionals would arrange it and record it into a song. And this song may very well have a life of its own. It might not merely be consigned to just your scrapbook. It might go out to radio stations, and who knows, you might have a hit on your hands. Stranger things have happened. And if there's a hit, you might even get royalties.
Please, Mr. Kennedy. Uh-oh.
If it hits number one, you know, there's only so far that we can hide the royalties from you. Eventually, you might even get a few cents. So that's what this documentary is about. We meet a number of people who were involved in the business. We learn of at least one person who may or may not have been driven to suicide by the business. And throughout, interesting questions are raised about where, if anywhere, is the art here. So you've become interested in song poems lately. I think you've been writing something about them. Any song poems you can recommend us? Are there really good ones?
Well, there's a song we're introduced to in this film called Blind Man's Penis, which certainly stuck out to me. It's not just the evocative title, although if I'm being honest, a lot of it is the evocative title.
What was that song, Jimmy Carter Says Yes? I was jamming to that one.
Jimmy Carter Says Yes is amazing. There's a Richard Nixon one as well. There's one that we see performed at the end of the film that is really, really bad. One of these guys goes to do some live music at a festival, which really he's just sort of singing from the porch of a trailer, accompanied by a guy who's strumming ill-formed chords out of time and far more quickly than the song demands. But yeah, I like the Chicken Insurrection song that he sings to an audience of about three or four. I really like how dignified he is after, where he's sort of saying, well, you know, we didn't get everything technically perfect, but I think some people were jamming, and you know, ultimately this just isn't my audience, you know. But yes, I am hoping to write something about song poems. And when I discovered, you know, I'd never heard of the song poem before until I discovered something called the American Song Poem Anthology, which I discovered because a copy of it in the early 2000s was a prize on the Ricky Gervais show, not the podcast, the XFM radio show that preceded the podcast, you know, Ricky Gervais, Stephen Merchant, and Carl Pilkington. A running gag on that show was how shitty the prizes for the even shittier contest they would do really were. But every so often, there'd be one that Merchant would go, huh, that's kind of good. And one of them was the American Song Poem Anthology, right alongside, you know, five copies of the Joaquin Phoenix movie Ladder 49, which if you look at the Wikipedia page for that movie, part of the article is that giving it away became a running gag on the Ricky Gervais show. Anyway, there is this album, the American Song Poem Anthology, and several of the songs from this movie are included in it. It's a kind of a soundtrack to this documentary. Thanks, by the way, to a number of our listeners who helped us locate this one. This is the second time in a few weeks that Michael and Us Nation has answered the call. We're going to try to resist the temptation to just have our listeners dig obscure stuff up for us, but so far it's been great results, so it may be hard to resist that temptation.
We may or may not post a temporary link on the Patreon for folks who want to watch this movie. It's just under an hour long. So keep an eye out for that if you're not already on patreon.com/Michael and Us.
Yeah, we may, or as Will says, may not, because that would be a violation of copyright, and everything we do on this show, from, you know, the music to everything else, strictly conforms to the letter of the law. Anyway, as you were saying, Will, I think, you know, the American Song Poem as an institution contains within it several different potentially interesting terrains of discussion. I think my point of entry into these is that because of the process that created them, they really are a very strange and quite unique kind of found art. I mean, when you think about most pop music, right, you know, most top 40 music, by definition, you know, in the history of radio as a mass medium, you know, it's very formulaic. It's very, you know, sort of derivative by definition, right? Because it has to be broad enough to capture a wide market share. You know, sometimes it produces things, it yields things that have, you know, that special little bit of stardust or whatever that makes something both very radio friendly and broad, but also beautiful and profound as well. But that's always been, you know, a tiny sliver amid the shit, to invoke something you said right off the top of the show. But what you have with the American Song Poem is this very strange co-mixing of the formulas and sounds that you find in pop music with just, you know, weird detritus harvested from across the landscape of American culture. And to me, there's something just inherently interesting about that. You very rarely find stuff that is this peculiar, that is nevertheless contained within a conventional format. And I just think that's incredible.
Yeah, one that comes to mind is there's an elderly woman in this documentary who had enough songs that she commissioned that they made a whole album of her work. And there's a picture of her on the piano on the cover. And when you hear the songs, at least one of them is about traffic safety.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, these odd songs about, you know, taking your time when you're driving your car, set against a fairly slick and derivative country music background.
I sent some of my songs to George Liberace Music, they called it at the time. And they liked them, and then one day they made the album with 13 of my songs on it.
Be careful when you drive. Stay carefree and alive.
Some of them, they interpreted a little bit different than I expected, but I liked it. I thought, well, now that's a good idea.
Right, and this is one of the things that's so incredible. These things are not uniform, right? They run the gamut from, yeah, like the Blind Man's Penis song or the song we hear off the top where the lyric is something like, I'm dressed like Captain Bicycle. Come and live the spirit of Jesus Christ. Thank Jehovah for judo bison rules, for kung fu bicycles and Priscilla Presley.
Gloria, show me yourself. Come and live the spirit of Jesus Christ. Thank Jehovah for Kung Fu Bicycles and Priscilla Presley. Angelaria, show me yourself. Come and live the spirit of Jesus Christ. Thank Jehovah for Kung Fu Bicycles and Priscilla Presley.
You get stuff like that that's just, totally weird. And then you also get stuff where, given full creative freedom and creative license, like no boundary is being imposed by anyone, no studio executive, no one on your creativity. There's no market pressure at all. You're writing lyrics, you're putting them in the mail, you're sending them to the record company with your $200 or whatever, and they're sending you back a nice little 45 with your song. And what do you get? You get an elderly woman and her thoughts on traffic safety, with like a sort of generic country twang flavor. You get a guy singing about his love for Jimmy Carter and doing lyrics like, can a government be competent? Jimmy Carter says so.
Amen.
I mean, that song about Jimmy Carter basically just sounds like something that would have been like, I don't know, a 2 or 3 minute radio spot. And when the guy talks about writing it, he's just an earnest admirer of Jimmy Carter. I mean, I think that's incredible. The experience this documentary most brought to mind for me was the experience of canvassing during elections, because if you go around during elections, does not matter where you go, you encounter like the most exotic combinations of ideology and belief imaginable. Like you find people who right away, they're like, yup, I'm voting for your guy, lifelong NDP supporter here, love Tommy Douglas and universal healthcare. And God damn it, we have too many immigrants. Why can't they all just stay where they belong? Or you get people who like open with something incredibly racist and then just start talking about something extremely weird. Or then maybe start talking about how much they love Jimmy Carter. And it's like, sir, nobody brought up Jimmy Carter. We're in Canada. Or my favorite version, which is the dogmatic liberals who you encounter, a lot of those in downtown Toronto, who then start telling you about conspiracy theories and shit like that. I love it. That is what watching this documentary and listening to these songs was for me.
So a lot of these companies would suggest that this could be your ticket into the music industry. Like, once the music industry hears your song about traffic safety set against our lush backdrop, like, you're the American Idol winner now. And there's one guy that we see whose song actually did chart somewhere. Like, it started at number 98 and then it made it up to number 44 or something. It might have even made it into the 30s. And they asked, did you see any money from this? And he's like, no. I mean, it was on the independent charts and they're not so reliable. It's not like the Billboard chart. And anyway, it was just nice to get the recognition. And that really is kind of what it is. I was reminded a little bit of, I couldn't watch this documentary and not think about Matt Farley, who we've talked about on the show, yes, of course, who, Matt Farley has figured out this way to, he's written 25,000 songs and he's figured out a way to, make a living off that. Because if a certain number of songs make a certain number of cents per year, that adds up to $60,000 or $70,000 a year, which is enough for a middle-class income. And you can get that by gaming the system and writing 25,000 songs. That's how to make a living on Spotify. And I remember him saying once that in the early 2000s, he put his music up on iTunes for the first time and he was so excited. And, nobody listened to it, but it was really cool to see your stuff on iTunes. Like Paul McCartney's on iTunes. And it's funny how embedded embedded in people's heads are certain forms that are legitimate. It's like, well, as long as it's on the iTunes, or in this documentary, as long as it's on a record album and it has the little text in the middle of it, and it even has a sleeve, then it's real somehow, even if we all know it's not real.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly how I felt when I uploaded my first podcast in something like 2007 to iTunes. And I was like, holy shit, it's on iTunes. I've made it.
Yeah, and it didn't change your life for some reason. But, you know, when people write about Matt Farley in the mainstream media, he has gotten a number of profiles in places like the Wall Street Journal or the Huffington Post or places like that. It's always with this kind of edge of like, wow, can you believe this guy has found a glitch in the matrix and he's figured out how to capitalize on it? There's always a sort of suggestion from these outlets that like he's a scammer in some way. And it's the most time consuming and least lucrative way to be a scammer is to write 25,000 songs that get you like 0.1 cent each. And in this documentary, like there's a suggestion that, well, maybe these companies were exploiting these people, you know, leading them on, selling them false dreams of maybe entering the music industry. But also these companies, these are pretty nickel and dime operations too. And they're not Spotify. They're all run by these independent artists who are also like just kind of trying to make a living. Some of whom, like it seems, after a while really hated themselves for having to like do this to their art.
Yeah, this was something I really liked about the documentary, is that it spends a fair bit of time in its second half showing you the studio musicians who have to actually put these songs together. And actually, it actually shows you, like, I think my favorite scenes in the movie were the scenes in the studio when they're actually recording these things. I mean, because basically none of this would work if there wasn't a reliable pool of studio musicians who are good enough at sight reading that they can basically sit down and with, you know, a chord structure and some lyrics that they're reading for the first time and some directives like, okay, you know, country blues shuffle or something like that, they can basically in one take make something that sounds like it's good enough to be played on the radio. And you can tell that this is absolutely torturous for some of them. I mean, as you alluded to earlier, Will, there's a story of a pianist named Rodney.
Or Rod Keith, that's his nom de plume is.
That's right. And he either killed himself or, you know, he fell off a bridge. No one was sure if it was suicide or not. But his lifelong ambition was to be a classical pianist. He absolutely hated doing these songs. But a number of the people who knew him, the other musicians who worked with him in the studio, you know, one of them says something really nice about him, which is that, you know, if you listen to his contributions to these songs, his, you know, enthusiasm for music, you know, made its way onto the records. You know, you can hear these flashes of brilliance. And I don't know, I thought that was really nice. But yeah, I mean, it's really good that the documentary chooses to show us the studio musicians as well, because, you know, it requires talent and technical proficiency to be able to have like an insane song that someone sent your way and, you know, put it to music and then record it in one take without fucking up and have something that sounds like a country blues or something come out the other end. And actually, the funniest scene in the movie is one where they're trying to record a song and the guitarist and the guy singing are just like very quickly at each other's throats. And then somehow, after a certain amount of time elapses, they somehow manage to recover and regroup and record the song.
Okay, now.
That's how it's written, Gene.
I know that, Del. I know exactly how it's written. God damn it. Look, I know what I'm doing. Please let me run.
We all know what we're doing.
The fuck you do. You listen to me. If I'm wrong, then we're all wrong.
Just go ahead and run.
All of this resonated very strongly with me, because if you are a creative person or consider yourself a creative person, one of the dreams is to be able to survive off your creativity. But even if you do survive off your creativity, you now find yourself on a whole spectrum of artistic compromise. You find yourself dealing with the art versus commerce question more than ever. I mean, for my part, I spent years as a professional writer. which is great because you're writing for a living. But then also, like, if what you're writing is corporate communications or like kind of fake journalism, well, then that's which I say with affection, fake journalism. It's what it is. You're writing fake news articles, or even for some of the places that are actual news places. Like if you're writing for a magazine and you're writing the listings or something, that might as well be fake journalism too. That's not too far from corporate communications. So then you're on that spectrum of artistic compromise. Then you say, well, this is the stuff that I do for money, and then there's other stuff that I do for love. But the problem is, the stuff you're doing for money is tapping both the energy and the talents, the craft that you use for the stuff that you love, to the point where, you know, at best, your energy, your drive to do the stuff that you love is depleted a little bit. And at worst, you're sullying those talents. This is one reason why Matt Farley's movie Local Legends means so much to me, because that's all about his own quest to become a professional musician. And he's figured out that, yeah, writing 25,000 songs and releasing them on Spotify is the way to do it. But then writing 25,000 songs is its own form of factory work. And then he and I, when I was a corporate communications writer, are also among the lucky ones, because at least we get to do that, you know?
That's right. You're the guys in the studio playing generic country blues chord progressions. You're not the people sending in the lyrics about Jimmy Carter or blind men's penises.
100%. You're in the industry. And then you find out what the industry actually is.
Yeah, this is a digression, but do you remember when the two of us were in student journalism, like what you thought making it was? Like, oh. Will and I aged, you know, 19, 20, 21. It was like we knew a few people, you know, often who'd been ex of the Varsity, our student newspaper, who are like 5 or 6 years older than us. And they'd have one article in like Maclean's or the Walrus or the Globe and Mail. And we were like, God, like, imagine if we got to be that person. Like, they've made it.
We have one mutual friend who did an internship at the Village Voice, which to me was just like, well, you're set. An internship at the Village Voice, which doesn't even exist anymore, by the way. The artist you mentioned, Rod Keith, who passed away untimely in 1974, possibly of suicide, we see an interview with his son, who never met him and has become a sort of preservationist of the Rod Keith estate. You know, he keeps track of his late father's music, and he sees his father's talent in this. He sees a bit of a ghost of the machine. At one point he says, in one of the most moving parts of the movie, he says,
keeping in mind, of course, that I never met my father, this music, it's all I've got, you know, so I've got to, you know, that's the sort of challenge of it. You know, I'm thrilled and amazed, you know, to have it. I mean, it does, the effect of it does not wear off. You don't take it for granted after all these years, you know. In a way, when you think about it, what a fantastic way to leave a legacy to somebody. He was a musician, and that's what he did. And this is maybe an odd version of what he did. It wasn't the whole picture, but, you know, it says a lot. I still think it says a lot. Not sure exactly what it says, but it speaks to me.
And I do think there's something kind of powerful in here. Even if somebody's job is to do hack work, or what they think of as hack work, you know, they are still a human being doing it. They bring all the baggage, all the background, all the skills and talents they have as a human being. And inevitably, it has to manifest in the work somehow.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the clips of the guys in the studio doing the songs, I think they're pretty impressive, honestly. Like, I wasn't watching those and thinking, oh, these guys are hacks. I was thinking, I can't sight read music that well. I couldn't do this.
Well, they make some really catchy songs out of these songs. That Jimmy Carter song works. As you said, it sounds like it could be on a campaign ad. And that is the result of human decisions. Even if they're doing this for the money only, they're making decisions to make it the best song they can. And in those decisions is the art. I don't know where any of this fits in, but the movie put me in mind of a couple of other cultural phenomena. Something I think you would like, Luke, is the phenomenon of itinerant filmmakers of the silent era. In the 1910s and 20s, there were filmmakers all over the United States and presumably Canada as well, who like had movie cameras and had film, and they would go from town to town and make a movie with the town. they would go to small towns and they would go, I guess, door to door, or they would go to the mayor, or they would go wherever people congregated and say, for a certain amount of money, I'll make a movie with all your kids and I'll edit it and I'll give them a script. And at the end of the week, we get to show it at the community barbecue and you get to own it. There's one that I recommend everybody check out called The Kidnapper's Foil by a guy named Melton Barker. It was made dozens, maybe even hundreds of times between the 1930s and the 1970s. He would just go from town to town and make this same movie over and over and over again with, you know, whatever kids were in the town. And you watch the movie and it's very sort of, for want of a better phrase, Ed Woodian. It's pretty cheesy, but quite charming. It has a real documentary power to it. And I don't know how many versions of it still exist. I was going to say that's the kind of thing that's been phased out with the introduction of things like home movie cameras, but it's really just sort of morphed forms because now people with money are like Frank D'Angelo or Tommy Wiseau, you know, they hire Eric Roberts to star in the movie that they pay for themselves.
Yeah. They find like a third tier Baldwin brother and pay him $15,000 to come to the studio for a day. They're all making Christopher Moltisanti's zombie mob movie over and over again.
Something else that this documentary reminded me a bit of is there are still things like these song poem industries out there. You remember Rebecca Black, the Friday video? Friday, Friday, gonna get down on Friday.
Yes, I remember the Rebecca Black Friday video. I wish you hadn't sung it.
I know you're really jealous that her family bought her a music video to be in and yours didn't get one for you. But that's basically the same principle. There was a business where people could, it may still exist, people could buy an opportunity for their kids to be in a music video, and they'd create like a shit song for them to sing and some generic, like, you know, looks like one of those videos that a karaoke machine would auto generate.
I was gonna say it looks like those weird videos that are generated by AI, except I guess people have like the right number of fingers.
I don't know how we incorporate AI into this discussion because, like, it's also sort of aggregating the median of the median of the median of whatever culture is, and it sort of aggregates a lot of different human factors. But it doesn't have its own animating human factor, which is what makes it less charming than these song poems.
Yeah, the duality of the song poem that I think is interesting, the tension in the song poem, is that these things really do run the gamut from being incredibly weird and just kind of these arbitrary and whimsical pastiches of like bits of culture, like the guy singing about judo and bicycles and Priscilla Presley and Jehovah all in the same song. That guy was my favorite, by the way. Talking about his themes, he says, I write about martial arts, ladies, religion, and science fiction too. And then he goes on to talk about how one of his great muses is Annie Oakley and, quote, the romantic interest I have in her spirit. Love that guy. But so you get all that stuff, you know, which then, you know, in the studio, once you've put your $100 in the mail or whatever, then meets, you know, the generic formula of a top 40 radio song. But then the other half of the songs, and this is what I think is really incredible, are just totally generic. Like we talked about the Jimmy Carter one. There's also a Richard Nixon one, a pro Richard Nixon one that's like, God in his infinite wisdom put Richard Nixon on this earth. There was a song that, from what you hear in the film anyway, basically just sounds like it, like it's 98% of the way to just being a pop song. The lyric is something like, what are we doing? Where are we going? Caravan, tell me, what is the big plan? And there's like almost nothing eccentric about it. Like, just riffing on the idea of a caravan. What is a caravan? You travel in it. It has possibility. Like it represents being in a liminal or transitory space in your mind and in your life. And the song just seems like it's a riff on that. Like that's basically what a pop song is, right? The component elements of a pop song are basically there. And what struck me about so many of them is that they basically just sound like ad jingles. And I'm not only talking about the music here, I'm talking about the lyrics as well. I mean, you mentioned the elderly woman who writes like these pains to traffic safety and, you know, crossing the street, you know, respecting your turn signals or whatever.
I'm not sure where this fits in either, but the thing about art that resonates is you can talk about Nepo babies, you can talk about privilege, you can talk about gatekeepers and barriers and huge corporate media budgets and all that. And all of that is very true. But taking all of those advantages into consideration, the art that really resonates is stuff that speaks to the moment in some way, stuff that is like part of the zeitgeist. And what's funny about a lot of the songs in this documentary is they have the form of something that would be of the moment. You know, they're derivative of, they're channeling styles and textures that are in the air at that time. And also the people doing them are not thinking about the moment or not consciously channeling at all in their words. And so you have a song like that, traffic safety song or something. There's a weird disconnect there. And these companies were promising people like a foot in the door of the music industry. And one of the many reasons why they couldn't deliver that promise is because there has to be that spark there. It actually has to be interacting with the world around it in a way that generates something.
I should have mentioned this off the top, but needless to say, between the year 1900 and 2002, there were apparently about 200,000 of these. It's just an estimate produced. And not one of them has ever become a hit. Not a single one, according to this film. Now, obviously, this whole style of making songs has been superseded by things like Spotify and SoundCloud and YouTube and all the rest of it, in which people have had hits. I mean, the same basic structure and hierarchy is there. You know, most content creators, to use a phrase I absolutely hate, you know, the vast majority aren't only not successful. I mean, they make, you know, zero money off of anything. Like a YouTube channel that has even 100,000 subscribers, let alone a million, is a very rare thing. A Patreon that has a few hundred subscribers is an incredibly rare thing. And one that has, you know, 5 or 10,000 is already in the top, you know, 0.001%. So I don't know, maybe our cultural machinery has gotten slightly better at democratizing the hit or the viral article or the viral video or whatever. But if so, it's only very slightly. Now, in all of the literature, as it were, I could find on the American song poem, one of the things that's constantly debated is whether this practice was exploitative or not. In the account offered by this film, anyway, most of the people seem pretty earnest about it, and it sort of seems like they're just paying for a service and, you know, are pretty happy with the product they get. You know, as you were saying earlier, I think for a lot of people, it's just thrilling to get a 45 that you've made in the mail. And some of them don't even seem too bothered by the fact that sometimes they'll have a concept for a song, they'll have an idea for the kind of music that, you know, their lyrics are going to be set to. And then the studio musicians do something totally different. And they're not even really bothered by it. They're just happy to have a song. Now, from my own vantage point, whether this is exploitative or not, I mean, I think it's both exploitative and not. I think it's both and neither. There's a comment from one of the people in the industry who says that within the industry, you know, they do call it song sharking. I think there is a general understanding among the people, you know, the suits, as it were, at the record companies and recording studios, and also the studio musicians themselves, that, you know, it's a little bit sleazy. Because as the guy goes on to say, in most cases, people really think their songs are going to be a hit. And underneath it all, to me, that is kind of the decisive comment about the American song poem. You know, to me, it really is a deep expression of the American civic ideology, of capitalism in the form of cultural ideology, not really in conversation or much less in conversation with other kinds of ideology or other cultural forces, as might be the case in other societies. You know, there's that off-cited John Steinbeck quote, which is kind of generic to invoke, but gets at something very real about how, you know, in American society, everyone thinks they're a temporarily embarrassed millionaire. And what I think the song poem does fundamentally is it commodifies that belief. So if there's a more American institution than this, I've never encountered it.
I got high last night on LSD. My mind was beautiful and I was free. Warts love my nipples because they are pink. Vomit on me, baby, yeah, yeah, yeah. A blind man's penis is a wreck because he is blind. It's a wreck because he is blind. A blind man's penis, it's a wreck because he's blind. It's a wreck because he's blind. Let's make love under the stars and watch for UFOs. If little baby Martians come out of the UFOs, keep up them, yeah, yeah, yeah. The zebra spilled his plastinia on Venus, and the gelatin fingers oozed electric marbles. Ramona's titties died in hell, and the Nazis want to kill, to kill everyone. A blind man's peace.